Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 11 for August 11th, 2009. I'm Dominic Rabia, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you today. First, Apple, AT&T, Google Voice, and the Federal Communications Commission. Then, a student got arrested for hacking his Xbox. How does this relate to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act? And finally, Iran is getting better at filtering the internet. Why can't the U.S. filter the internet, and other issues relating to net censorship? Let's get right to that first story, Apple, AT&T, Google Voice, and the FCC. So Google, as everyone knows, is the world's largest search engine, and they have a product called Google Voice. This actually is technology they bought from a company called Grand Central a couple of years ago. And basically what Google Voice allows you to do is have one phone number that anyone can call, and then this number will basically go... The software will, once someone calls this number, the software will figure out, all right, who is calling, look through your address book, and if it's somebody who has permission to call your cell phone number, it'll automatically route it to your cell number or ring all your numbers at once. It also has the ability to transcribe voicemail for you. So if someone leaves you a voicemail, it can do speech recognition on it and just send you a transcript to your email. It's in a closed beta. You can request a beta invite. I did personally a couple months ago and actually got it, so I've had a little bit of experience using it. It's pretty cool. So anyway, Google came up with an iPhone app for Google Voice to make it easier to use Google Voice. Like right now, you would have to go to the website and kind of click around, but with the iPhone app, it would be integrated with the iPhone, and it submitted it to Apple. Apple, because it oversees everything that goes into the App Store, decided not to accept the app and told Google as much. Please actually rewrite this as a web app. Don't make it an application in the Apple Store. The reason, I think, was something along the lines of duplicates existing functionality of the iPhone. And that was that. Google, somehow, it's unclear exactly how, but this drew the attention of the FCC, and the FCC wrote some letters to Google, AT&T, and Apple. AT&T is the exclusive provider of the iPhone in the United States. So all iPhones, unless they're jailbroken, which is a topic we'll somewhat touch on in the second story, have to use the AT&T network. And the FCC basically wrote letters to Google, AT&T, and Apple. With Google, they asked, what does Google Voice do? What sort of technology does it have? Are there any other apps that are similar? With Apple, they asked, all right, well, why did you guys reject this? And with AT&T, they said, did you guys have any part in rejecting this, or did you influence Apple to reject this? AT&T sort of wrote back in a sort of non-denial that they said that they don't manage or approve applications for the App Store, but that they will provide the FCC with a full response. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they did or didn't have any involvement, but it's an interesting story in that it gives us a chance to talk about a lot of things, including the App Store, FCC, the Federal Communications Commissions, and all the communications law. So let's just dive right in. Anything else? Anything I left out of that summary, guys?
I think you got pretty much everything.
It sounded great to me.
So let's talk about what does the FCC have to do with telephones and telephony and Google Voice?
My understanding is that the FCC is sending these questions to Google, Apple, and AT&T in conjunction with a broader inquiry that they're doing at the request of Congress into exclusivity agreements and telephones. So the FCC has, through Congress, the ability to regulate both all wired and wireless communications in the United States. So the FCC regulates what goes on your TV, and that's when you heard about the lawsuit and the investigation over Janet Jackson's Nipplegate. That's the FCC regulating decency of broadcasts. There was a Supreme Court case recently about fleeting expletives, and the FCC regulates what people are and are not allowed to say, and specifically during what hours they're allowed to say it or not on television. FCC also has regulatory power over the wires. That includes telephones, that includes the internet, which we'll get to later, and that includes cable television. So FCC is, you know, exerting their power to regulate these things and investigating this activity in conjunction with that power.
That's a great rundown, Ben. There, just to get a little bit more specific, the FCC was created in Title 47 of the U.S. Code, and that's the portion of the U.S. Code that where Congress has officially enabled the creation of the FCC. And it's good because it states some nice broad purposes here, so I'm just going to lift it right out of the statute itself. And so it says, for the purpose of regulating interstate and foreign commerce and connection by wire and radio, so as to make available, so far as possible, to all the people of the United States, without discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex, a rapid, efficient, nationwide, and worldwide wire and radio communication service with adequate facilities at reasonable charges for the purposes of national defense. Then it goes on and on and on. But basically, you get the gist there that the FCC has got some pretty broad authority. And some of the key areas that they're going to look at is the competition and creation, and to make sure that things are sort of created in a way that encourages the growth of this nationwide communications network.
Right. Specifically, when the FCC passes regulations, they have to be in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And if the FCC actually does go on and pass any rules or regulations regarding exclusivity agreements, the test that they're going to be measured against is whether or not the rules that were passed were in the public interest, convenience, or necessity.
So is there a reason that the exclusive partnerships are being considered by the FCC and not the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission? Wouldn't that sort of almost be an antitrust issue?
It could be an antitrust issue, but as I posted on the blog, and this is going to be a link to this article, is going to be in the show notes. This was back on June 25th. The FCC has much broader range of regulations they can pass. It would be much easier for the FCC to pass a law banning these exclusivity agreements than it would be for the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Justice or even private parties to try to bring an antitrust action or anti-competitive business behavior action to stop this.
Makes sense. So Apple owns the App Store. Can they just deny whatever app they want? Or, I mean, what can the FCC do in terms of saying, because this isn't, Google Voice doesn't really come into play in terms of what the FCC is looking at with exclusive deals between Apple and AT&T. So how does Google Voice come into the picture with the FCC?
Well, I think what they're mostly concerned about...
Sorry.
Go ahead. So I think what they're mostly concerned about is what's the ultimate effect on the competition in the marketplace in the end of the day. They don't want one particular company to sort of quickly grab a stranglehold on it and be able to push out all the other competitors. And basically, Apple is operating as a gate into the world of mobile applications on just the iPhone. And it's, they have an agreement also with AT&T, sort of linked into this as well. So you've got these sort of two interested parties that are, making decisions about what applications should and should not be in the App Store. And, I think that the FCC is concerned about, well, what decisions are they making? Are they going to completely foreclose portions of the market just so that they can continue to have their stronghold on it?
Sounds good. So what can the FCC actually do? Can they force Apple to approve this app?
I'm not really sure if the FCC has that power. I think they're investigating this partly because there's so much public outcry about it. And in conjunction with this, I really don't think the FCC... I mean, they could pass a regulation that says if you have an application store, you can't deny an application on the basis of the fact that the application provides a competing telephony service. Telephony? Yeah, telephony.
Yes, yeah. There we go.
Ha! Totally got that right. But it doesn't strike me as... I don't think the FCC is going to go to Apple and say, you have to accept a native application version of this when Google has already now released a web application.
One thing that's sort of curious about this case is that there were third-party apps that worked with Google Voice. There was one called GV Mobile, and they were also pulled when Apple rejected Google's official Google Voice app, whereas before they were available for sale. And now they're not available anymore. People who bought them presumably are trying to get refunds from the person they purchased from, but the apps are no longer available. Why might have Apple pulled third-party applications when they decided to reject the Google Voice app? Why hadn't they blocked those applications initially? Because is my understanding correct of the App Store process that Apple reviews every single app before it puts it on the store?
That's what Apple claims to do. There's been a whole host of issues with apps being accepted, then being taken down, apps being rejected for no good reason. It's a very long storied history with the App Store. My personal guess, and there are some commentators who agree with this, is what probably happened is AT&T caught wind of this and either informed Apple that they were not happy with it or informed Apple that the Google Voice apps violate some term in the AT&T contract with Apple, and that Apple then went and took down, refused to allow the Google Voice app and then took down the similar ones. Again, if I had to guess, I'd say it was because it violated some term in a contract rather than Apple was just being spiteful.
Dave, any thoughts on this?
So we have the rejection of the application itself, and then we have like sort of the bigger question that's going on there is, you know, is the exclusivity provisions that in wireless contracts and sort of the way in which these companies have made it so difficult to, or they've sort of made it difficult to jump in between carriers and stuff. I mean,
I wrote a post about it. There's not a whole lot to say other than that the FCC's power to regulate this is broader than the FTC's power or the DOJ's power to, you know, prevent these allegedly anti-competitive contracts.
So what can they do, though? I mean, can they jump in and break up these agreements, declare them unlawful? I'm a little unclear on exactly what their power was. I was trying to dive into some of that.
Right. Okay, so in order to clarify a little what the FCC's power would be here, I mentioned the standard earlier. It has to be, the regulations they pass have to be in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And it's a little difficult to tell whether or not a regulation would pass this. And in the end, it's going to be, you know, if the FCC passes a regulation that says you cannot have exclusive agreements between a handset manufacturer and a wireless service provider like AT&T, like Verizon, like Sprint, if that kind of thing gets handed down, it's going to be challenged in court. And whether or not the court that reviews it finds that it's in the public convenience, interest, or necessity is going to be based entirely on the factual record that the FCC develops when it's passing the regulation and the factual record that the FCC can develop during a trial. And that factual record is going to consist of things like the problems that exist. Like people have trouble getting 3G service certain places. You can buy a 3G iPhone, and the 3G iPhone, you have to buy the 3G contract. But, you know, for example, in Petaluma, where Leo Laporte does his work, there was no 3G network. And that's, you know, certainly a problem when if it were on Verizon, there would be a 3G network, and he would be able to get that service. The people like Apple, like AT&T, would counter back saying that in order to recoup, you know, Apple's cost, in order to recoup the cost that we're eating, that AT&T is eating, by giving these things at a reduced cost, we have to have that period of exclusivity. And that it's in the public interest, convenience, and necessity to allow this period of exclusivity to allow people to recoup their costs and to lower prices for consumers.
It's an excellent summary. Thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
So the next stage in this story is probably going to come in August 21st, or the next Monday after that, because the FCC requested that AT&T, Apple, and Google all provide answers to their various questions at that date. So I'm not sure whether the public will have access to those answers, but it will certainly provide the next chapter of this story, and we'll keep you up to date on that. And now let's move on to our next story, which is about a student who is hacking video game consoles in order to enable them to basically circumvent the copyright protection so that pirated games would be playable. And the student was arrested in his home because he was allegedly violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a law passed in 1998 by Congress, which makes it illegal to try to circumvent any sort of copyright protection. Ostensibly, the student said that he was simply enabling people to make backup copies, and he wasn't interested in helping people pirate, but practically, it was basically used for the express purpose of piracy. Dave, can you tell us a little about what the DMCA is and why it exactly applies to this case?
Well, sure. The DMCA is just a portion of the Copyright Act in the end of the day. As you mentioned, in 1998, this new legislation popped up, and it effectively amended portions of the Copyright Act itself. Within section, what's now known as Section 1201, you have the anti-circumvention portions of the DMCA, and basically what it does is it makes it unlawful for a person to circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected. It's a bunch of words that basically means if you try to usurp any DRM protection that's on a copyrighted piece of work, you're going to be liable under the Copyright Act. What's interesting about this case is he's actually being brought up on criminal charges. And another thing that is under the DMCA is in Section 1204, you have some criminal offenses for So if you violate Section 1201, which is the anti-circumvention, so if you try to crack that DRM and make it able, if you make the work playable on other things, like it seems to be happening here, if you're willfully doing that under Section 1204, you're basically criminally liable, and so you can be brought up on federal charges and arrested, and that's basically what happened in this story.
Ben?
I think Dave got that right. I'm not really sure what to add there.
I guess,
the key thing here is whether or not he was doing this for a commercial advantage.
Whether he was doing what? Sorry?
Whether he was doing this for a commercial advantage. So the key language here says
that. You're trailing in and out here, Dave. I think what he's trying to say is the principal question is, in order to be liable under this statute, you have to be doing it either for personal... let me get the statutory language. Purpose of commercial advantage or private financial gain. And we seem to have lost Dave completely, so we're just going to keep on powering on until we can get him back on the call.
All right. So it does look like he was doing this for financial gain, because apparently he charged about $30 for every time he did the... One story calls this jailbreaking, but this isn't actually... jailbreaking. This is just sort of disabling some of the copyright protection. It's circumvention, in other words, not jailbreaking. Ben, do you want to talk about a little bit about what jailbreaking is and how it differs from just circumvention of copyright protection?
Absolutely. So the way I understand it is jailbreaking is usually a term, at least the first time I ever heard it was with regard to the iPhone. The way the iPhone is, the way the file system on the iPhone is constructed, most of the software is kept in what the hackers call a jail. It's a place where the users don't have automatic access to it. By jailbreaking, you essentially just change the permissions on it to allow the regular user to edit that area. Meanwhile, hacking and what was done in this case actually involves changing software on the phone. In this case, it was circumventing some sort of copy protection in order to get access to the firmware. Dave, if you're back, say something right now.
Hi guys, can you hear me again?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Any thoughts on jailbreaking versus the circumvention that happens in this case?
Not entirely, but interestingly, every year the Copyright Office, they'll hold these proceedings in which they want to get some public feedback on exceptions to anti-circumvention provisions. I mean, one of the key contentions of some of the scholars out there is that having the anti-circumvention provision in the DMCA, it sort of chills academic research, and it's you know, if people are circumventing DRM just for their own purposes and not for the like a willful purpose to disseminate a copyrighted work across a peer-to-peer network or something like that, you know, something that would be grossly unlawful. Absent any of that, you know, personal use and circumventing DRM might be okay. And every year, people try to get Congress to make an official exception to that particular provision, and I think they've been pretty unsuccessful up to this point. And Ben, do you know what the status is of jailbreaking under that? As far as I know, it hasn't been included as an exception.
Right. So jailbreaking, to the best of my knowledge, does not include circumventing any type of copy protection. It does involve, usually, copyright infringement in another way, which is that you have to either download a version of the firmware from the internet, or which would be a violation of copyright, or you need to somehow take the firmware off of your own phone, modify that firmware, and then reload it onto your phone. There are programs that will do this for you, but it would still involve making an authorized copy of that firmware. And you could argue that firmware is almost entirely non-expressive, but I mean that's.
You could, you know, the I think the key language here under Section 1201, the anti-circumvention section, is that you're not allowed to circumvent any technological measure that effectively controls access. It doesn't really say anything about the ultimate copying that you're doing in the process. So that's kind of why jailbreaking still falls underneath, you know, the Copyright Act, even though it seems like it kind of shouldn't, because you're not really copying too much, or you're not necessarily copying anything in the process.
Well, you're loading aspects into memory that are copyrighted. I mean, Apple has said specifically with regard to jailbreaking the iPhone that they feel that jailbreaking the iPhone violates their copyright.
Sure. I think that there were, in one of the first iterations of the iPhone, you were actually, some of the jailbreaking hacks were done on the hardware itself by, you know, creating new traces actually on the circuit board. Is that right? Do you guys remember?
Mm-hmm.
So okay. In that sense, you don't have to load anything into memory. You could have a hardware hack that basically totally gets rid of you know, a technological measure.
I think, so, David, you were thinking of some of the original unlocks as opposed to jailbreaks.
Oh, you know what? I think you're right.
Yeah. So jailbreaking is entirely a software thing. Unlocking it is just enabling the phone to work on other networks.
Right.
And yes, I do believe there was, if not actually in practice, a few people alleged that they did a hardware unlock of the phone to allow the iPhone, which is exclusive to AT&T, to work on other GSM networks, either across the sea or something like T-Mobile in the United States.
Well, that just goes to show you how broadly the language can actually be construed under this particular provision of the act itself, because in some ways, you know, you can perceive of a way that a potential plaintiff could create some sort of civil liability basically for doing those types of things, even if it's not purely with the software itself, but also involves the hardware.
So the interesting thing about the DMCA is that any circumvention of protection that controls access to a copyrighted work is a violation, even if you should be able to access the copyrighted work regardless. In other words, theoretically, if the protection goes haywire and it's not allowing you access, even though you have a right to access, that doesn't matter, because going around the circumvention or circumventing the protection itself is a violation of the DMCA, regardless whether you have an underlying right to use the copyrighted work or even a fair use right to use the copyrighted work.
Right, that's what kills me in the end of the day sometimes about this provision, and you know, I certainly understand why it's there and why it's important for companies to be able to, you know, protect them under this portion of the Copyright Act. But it also seems like it's a really easy way for people to, you know, just they throw a little DRM, they throw some sort of wrapper that's just basically controlling access to their underlying copyrighted work, and you have potentially eliminated a large scheme of fair use rights. And, you know, that seems a little bit unfortunate, because the, you know, fair use has always been the balancing factor in the Copyright Act, and it's, you know, sort of limited that expansive scope of rights that are granted to people that are creating content.
Right. One thing I'd like to point out, though, is that while any violation of the DMCA can lead to civil remedies, So let's say I unlocked my jail, my iPhone, or I jailbroke my iPhone. Apple could personally go against me for whatever damages I caused to Apple by doing that. That would not necessarily open me up to criminal liability unless I did it, as we were saying before, and now I want to pull up the language just so I get it right.
Right, well, I have it right in front of me, and I can chime back in because I think this is where I dropped right off. But,
yes, it was.
You know, it requires that you do it willfully for the purpose of commercial advantage, so or private financial gain. So in the end of the day, you have to be doing this because you want to make money on it, and you want to be running some sort of business. That's the key difference to doing it, you know, for just pure
Dave, you went fuzzy there for a second. Are you still with us?
I should just stay away from this portion of the statute. It seems to be killing my mic.
Yes, it is.
Perhaps it's a sign.
Did you guys get any of that? Did it just totally click out again?
We got the vast majority of it, I think.
Okay, good. I mean, you know, that's
it just went fuzzy. So.
Okay, good. So I think we got that then.
Okay.
So what defenses does this guy have? He's just been arrested. He's got two counts of violating the DMCA against him. His defense apparently so far is that, well, I was just helping people do backup. I didn't really want to do any piracy, but it doesn't really matter because he was charging for the privilege and people, and it seems like that was just sort of, for lack of a better word, his cover. Is there any defense that he can say? Or any, like, say he picks you guys as his lawyers, what would you guys advise him without making any legal advice?
I mean,
I think one of the things that I'd be interested in is looking at exactly what he was doing and determining whether we could separate any of the income that he was getting from his unlocking of the devices. That's a really steep hill to try to, you know, go up to make this argument. But I think that if you can separate the financial aspect, any of the profits or any financial gains that he was getting from doing these services for people from the what he was calling backup in the end of the day, you might be able to separate it enough that it would sort of give him a boost in the right direction to sort of stay away from criminal liability.
Right. I mean, even more basic, I'd want to know how the police found out about this. I'd want to know how the police got evidence of his circumvention of this. Was it a policeman who came up to him with an Xbox and said, can you mod this Xbox? And if so, is there an entrapment defense? I mean, from what I understand, there probably isn't because he had a propensity to modify these things anyway. And
from what I understand, the federal agents went, the neighbor apparently alerted the Entertainment Software Association the fact that he was doing this, and then federal agents went undercover and they had two systems circumvented. So, but an entrapment defense is basically, do you want to explain an entrapment defense, Ben?
Yes. So an entrapment defense says that the police, I would not have committed this crime, but for the police coming up to me and telling me that, and you know, suggesting that I commit this crime. So to be controversial for a moment, a handful of the terrorism prosecutions that the U.S. Attorney's Office have been doing recently are cases where you get a bunch of low-level schmo criminals who get approached by a federal informant who claims to have a lot of money and access to guns, weapons, and implements of destruction and asks them if they want to blow up the Sears Tower. And they go, oh yeah, it sounds awesome. And so their defense is, well, we wouldn't have tried to blow up the Sears Tower if it weren't for the federal informant who came up to us and offered us all of the means to do this. Now, if you try to offer an entrapment defense, the government can come back and, excuse me, they have to prove that you would have done it anyway. And the way they can do this is by showing specific other bad acts. So if the government has proof of other systems that this guy modified, they can say, well, yeah, we asked you to modify these ones, but here are, you know, 80 other systems that you modified. And then, by the way, judge, tell the jury that they shouldn't consider those as criminal acts. They should just consider those as evidence that he would have, you know, been modifying those anyway. And that's my unfairness of the criminal system rant for the day.
All right.
I'm always impressed by Ben's knowledge and criminal procedure, so kudos, Ben.
All right, let's move on to our final story. This one is perhaps more open for discussion. So the Iranian government has apparently become more efficient at filtering its internet after the attempted Twitter revolution, if you want to call it that. Traffic apparently spiked down significantly, and then it's slowly been crawling back up. And it looks like the ISPs have done a interestingly better job of filtering what the people inside Iran can access. So let's just sort of make this a little broader in terms of why doesn't the U.S., for example, I mean, apart from the First Amendment concerns, or we can talk about First Amendment concerns as well, why doesn't the U.S., say, filter our internet in what we can see in the United States? China also has a particularly, the Great Firewall of China, as it's often called. But let's just sort of talk about internet filtering, why it matters, what's technically possible, what's legally possible, sort of an open discussion on that.
Well, Ben. As for whether or not we were, why the U.S. doesn't do it but for the First Amendment, my answer was going to be entirely the First Amendment there. The U.S. has tried to essentially filter the internet in several ways. I think the only way they've been effective in doing it is by tying the internet filtering to a spending clause. So the United States Congress can enact legislation many different ways. One of the most common ways is the Commerce Clause, saying that if, you know, some activity affects interstate commerce, they can affect power over it. They can put in a regulation. The only time that I think, and this is off the top of my head, that the United States currently has any part in actively filtering the internet, besides within the walls of government facilities, is public libraries that receive assistance from the federal government must have a filter in place. Correct? Is anyone else familiar with that law?
That's not an area that I'm really familiar with.
I remember reading about it. I'm not sure whether that's still the case. I believe it was challenged in court. Yeah, well, basically it looks like the Third Circuit in 2002 ruled that it was under the Children's Internet Protection Act.
Yeah, COPA.
Oh, yes, COPA.
And, well, not COPA, not the Children's Online Protection Act. This is the CIPA, Children's Internet Protection Act. And the court basically said that the Federal Communications Commission can't cut off funds to libraries that don't filter. Not because, and they basically focused the decision on the fact that software is imperfect. There are bugs in software, and it might filter too much, or overblock, or underblock. Okay. And because it's not perfect, it isn't effective.
That's funny. Their ACLU is doing a similar case in Washington right now. Okay, but that's a state law.
That was the Third Circuit in 2002. The Supreme Court in 2003 said that that same law, in a 6-3 decision in 2003, they said that the libraries could turn off the software upon request,
right.
But it was all right to restrict funding to it. So it was overruling that Third Circuit ruling that I just mentioned. But you're getting the law in temporal order, if you will, the way it actually was. So basically, the current position of the law, I believe, is that the Federal Communications Commission can tell libraries, if you don't install these filters, we will restrict funds to you. However, you must say to patrons that if you want us to disable the filter, we can do that for you. That way, the free speech right is protected, and Congress can legislate basically in saying that they want to encourage filters in libraries so long as free speech or free access to the internet is not impinged upon by the filter itself, because a patron can ask a librarian, excuse me, librarian, I wish to look at filtered materials. Would you please turn off the filter? I'm sure that won't be awkward at all.
I mean, in the defense of patrons at the library, these filters do tend to catch a lot of stuff that is, no one disagrees, is protected speech. Famously, Boing Boing gets filtered out a lot, which for the most part is a very clean website. And dvorak.org/blog often gets filtered out.
Yeah, I heard about that.
So the First Amendment is the reason the U.S. doesn't filter the internet. How does a country actually filter the internet? Like, technologically speaking, how does Iran do it? I mean, they basically, do they just go to every connection in and out of the country? But what, I mean, obviously they can't filter a satellite if someone has satellites, so I guess they restrict the input of satellite devices into their country? Or do either of you know exactly how this happens? Or, I mean, not perhaps exactly, but...
Well, I think there's about 5 or 6 ISPs in Iran, and my knowledge is that there's something that the actual ISPs are participating in with the government, and they're sort of the ones that are at least partly responsible for the filtering. Through technological means, there's a bunch of different ways they could do it, from, you know, compiling a list of inbound IP addresses from outside of the country, or even perhaps the ones that are inside the country that, you know, they put onto a list, and they somehow, somewhere, someone in a room decides that, you know, these particular websites that are associated with these IP addresses are not ones that we want, you know, members of our citizens. They just create a block list like that. They could be doing deep packet inspection and, you know, a bunch of other things too, to also block out sites.
All right. Ben, any closing thoughts on this story?
Not really, other than that as much as we may complain about the United States, I think we should all take a moment to remember that we have the freest internet, both as in forms of what we can say on it and what can we can receive, and as far as the laws associated with internet and defamation on the internet, than perhaps any other country, or at least any other country that I know of. And, you know, while there's a lot to complain about in the United States, the treatment of the internet is not one of those things.
Those are our 3 stories for this week. But before we close, we want to make a mention of a new book and a companion blog that were launched recently by William Patry, who currently serves as Google's chief copyright officer, although his blog and his book do not necessarily represent his views at Google, which he is always quick to point out. His new book is called Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars. And basically, the premise of his book is that copyright isn't so much a fixed form of property as it's often taught, but is more sort of... a social contract that needs to be set up so that it operates in the public interest. In other words, the regulations need to be set up so that it's not so much that people are stealing, for example, when they download songs necessarily, but there needs to be a refined form of copyright law that better serve society, as opposed to just simply defending property owners as such. He used to blog about copyright until about last year, when he shut down his blog because he said that he felt that the state of copyright law was just too depressing, and that people kept quoting him as if he were speaking for Google, even though he works for Google. He doesn't necessarily. I mean, he can speak independent of Google, but the book and the blog are both worth checking out, and it's William Patry, Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars. He just started the blog, so you only have one post to read, and I'm sure he'll be posting many more. So, any other
questions? Patry's a really interesting guy. I mean, he's one of the foremost recognized scholars on copyright law in the United States, and he's also in a really unique position as one of the senior council members at Google. And even though when he's commenting on his blog, he's obviously not speaking for Google, but you have to sort of respect the fact that he is doing it with a ton of experience, and he gets to see a lot of interesting things about the way that the internet is reshaping the way that we might think about intellectual property law. So even though he's not officially commenting on behalf of Google, you have to still suspect that, you know, there's a lot that goes into his blog that relates to things that might have occurred there.
Right. He was a congressional aide during one of the last major revisions of the Copyright Act, so the man has quite a bit of information on the current copyright laws and how they're being applied.
And also a great treatise out there, too, as well.
If you're in your mood for treatises, yes, it is a rather rich and large treatise. That's all for this week. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening. I'll be gone in Europe next week, so you'll just have Ben and Dave and perhaps a special guest. So enjoy, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Take care.